Hey, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to this week's message. My name's Aaron, and I'm on the staff team here at Eastlake. Everything we do around here depends on the generous donations of our local and online community, people just like you, who tune into these messages and see great benefit from living that idea that life is a gift and love is the point. So if you love what Eastlake is up to, we'd encourage you to contribute by going to eastlakecc.com. With that, let's jump into this week's message. Today, we are continuing the series we started last week called The End, and I'm excited. I'm going to invite my friend Dave to come up now. Dave Bailey is not only one of us, this is a member and a deep participant in our communal life together, Dave Bailey. Dave has spent decades in pastoral ministry before being a part of our congregation here. He is a professional officiant and helps people with these big end-of-life transitions, really week in and week out. What did you do, like 3-4 memorials in this last week, really? In this last week? There you go. So, without further ado, I just want to say, brother, by the way, felt that coming. Maybe I won't. Maybe I won't cry in front of everyone. But I love you, and it's been great getting to know you as a neighbor and a friend and a fellow walk participant on the trail. Well, you do a great job of welcoming our friend, Dave Bailey. Yeah.
Thank you so much. It really is an incredible privilege to share today as part of our series on major life transitions. And a little intimidating. So many amazing communicators grace this stage. And so I asked Ryan, I sent him over my manuscript and I asked him if he would just kind of cut out anything that was boring or unnecessary or irrelevant. So if you would stand with me as we close. Thank you for that laughter on the front row. That's awesome. A little bit of my background. I graduated from an Assemblies of God Bible College, and I made my living as a professional Christian for a lot of years. Youth pastor, senior pastor, church planter. I've run a group home for severely troubled teenage boys. I've done community development and church planting in Australia. I've done a lot of professional development for church leaders throughout Africa. I'm trained in detox acupuncture and hypnotherapy, and I was involved in the recovery community for many years. And now, as Ryan said, for the last 3 years, what I tell people when they ask me what I do is I tell them that I run an escort agency. That I work for Dignity Memorial Funeral Homes as a celebrant, and I have the honor of escorting people from this world to the next. Dignity is the nation's largest provider of funeral, cremation, and cemetery services, and we have about 22 locations in the Seattle market, and whenever anybody comes into those locations and they don't have a spiritual community to do their service, I get to meet with them and plan authentic and creative end-of-life celebrations for them. So over the last 3 years, I've worked with close to 500 families, and I can tell you that at times it is a very daunting task. And I say all that to say that I am familiar with death and with loss and with grief. Personally, I know what it's like to come to the end of a marriage, the end of a ministry, and to be forced to look the end of life right in the face when the doctor comes in to give you the results of your biopsy and drops the C word on you and begins to describe the next year of your treatment. So we're going to talk about death this morning. But more specifically, we're going to talk about the invitation that death extends to all of us to really live while we're alive. And we're going to deal with some concepts. Then we've got a little experiential processing to do. We're going to extend an invitation to sign up for a workshop, and then we'll wrap it up. So, we good? Yeah. Let's get started. There's a quote that's usually attributed to Ben Franklin that goes like this. In this world, nothing can be said to be certain except death and taxes. But you know, if you have a good accountant, you might be able to avoid the taxes part of that equation. Just ask our president. Did I say that out loud? But for all of us, death runs in our families. And the one thing that is truly certain in this world is impermanence. Death and life share a common border. And for all of us, life is a constant, unending process of impermanence and change, and an inexorable march toward the borderland. Zen master Shunryu Suzuki Roshi said it this way. He said, life is like getting into a boat that's just about to sail out to sea and sink. Everything in life is impermanent. Newborns become infants who become demon-possessed toddlers, who become fountains of insatiable energy as children, and then moody teenagers, young adults, college kids, newlyweds, parents, grandparents, retirees, seniors, elderly. The new car will one day be an antique, the new clothes threadbare, the new house sagging at the main beam. Everything that we have and use and touch wears down and wears out. And death is the ultimate and universally unavoidable impermanence. And yet it is typically the one that we are least prepared for and the one that we have least reconciled ourselves to. And yet, pondering the geography of that unknown land on the other side of life's border, whatever you think it looks like, has a strange and a mystic ability to give life to life, to make every moment of that which we know is finite and fragile and fleeting, filled with energy and intensity and purpose. That idea was captured so powerfully in the lyrics of Tim McGraw's song, Live Like You Were Dying. He said, I was in my early 40s with a lot of life before me when a moment came that stopped me on a dime. I spent most of the next days looking at the x-rays, talking about the options, talking about sweet times. I asked him when it sank in that this might really be the real end. How's it hit you when you get that kind of news? Man, what'd you do? He said, I went skydiving. I went Rocky Mountain climbing. I went 2.7 seconds on a bull named, help me out,
Fu Manchu.
And I loved deeper. And I spoke sweeter and I gave forgiveness I'd been denying. And he said, someday, I hope you get the chance to live like you were dying. He said, I was finally the husband that most of the time I wasn't. And I became a friend would like to have. And suddenly going fishing wasn't such an imposition. And I went 3 times the year I lost my dad. Finally read the good book and I took a good, long, hard look at what I'd do if I could do it all again. And then he said, I went skydiving. I went Rocky Mountain climbing. I went 2.7 seconds on a bull named Fu Manchu. I love that line. And I loved deeper and I spoke sweeter and I gave forgiveness I'd been denying. And he said, someday, I hope you get the chance to live like you were dying. Like tomorrow was a gift and you had eternity to think about what you'd do with it. What could you do with it? What would you do with it? What did you do with it? Really comprehending your mortality, which most often doesn't happen until we are face to face with it, is a powerful, clarifying force. In one of Carlos Castaneda's books, Don Juan, who is a Yaqui Indian shaman, says to him, "Death is our eternal companion. It is always to our left at an arm's length. It has always been watching you, and it always will until the day it taps you. The thing to do when you're impatient is to turn to your left and ask advice from your death. An immense amount of pettiness is dropped if your death makes a gesture to you, or if you catch a glimpse of it, or if you just catch the feeling that your companion is there watching you." Author Mark Manson phrased it this way: "Without acknowledging the ever-present gaze of death, the superficial will appear important, and the important will appear superficial. Death is the only thing we can know with any certainty. And as such, it must be the compass by which we orient all of our other values and decisions. It is the correct answer to all of the questions that we should ask, but never do." My friend Dave Browning, who I worked with for a number of years at Christ the King, has through his life and writings affected people around the globe. And a couple of years ago, at age 52, he was suddenly diagnosed with an inoperable brain tumor. And before his passing, he shared these thoughts in a blog post. He said, "Time really is precious. Well, it's not time, I guess, but what you get to do with it and with whom. Unless the hourglass gets flipped over, my time seems to be running out. I wish so much that I had not spent any of it complaining or doubting or worrying or being afraid. Every moment I wasn't loving someone or letting them love me is a moment I'd like to have back now." After his first diagnosis of cancer at a commencement address at Stanford in 2005, Steve Jobs said, "Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations, all pride, all fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. Remembering that you are going to die is the best way that I know to avoid the trap of thinking that you have something to lose. You are already naked. There is no reason not to follow your heart." Jesus looked out at his friends one day and he said, "If any of you wants to be my follower, you must give up your own way, take up your cross, and follow me. If you try to hang on to your life, you will lose it. But if you give up your life for my sake, you will save it. What do you benefit if you gain the whole world but lose your soul? Is anything worth more than your soul?" And I know that we typically read that theologically. You know, the preacher will step up and say, There's a heaven to gain. And there's a hell to shun. And you need to get your soul right with God so that when you pass over, you can fall into the arms of a loving God and not into the hands of an angry God. For what would you give? What would you give in exchange for your soul? Am I right about it? Hey, yeah. Ryan, would you like to comment on that? Oh, God. Thank God we only have 35 minutes because I could riff on that one for a while. If you'll permit me, I believe there's another realistic, deeper, lived out implication. Essentially, it seems to me that what he's saying to them is this: I am reconciled to my death. I know what the inevitable end of speaking truth to power in the way that I do will be, and I am fully reconciled to it. And because of that, I can live out my passion and my calling and my purpose without fear and without compromise. Then he goes on to say, if you want to follow my example, you must give up your self-preservation and prepare to follow your heart and follow your dreams, no matter what it costs you, because the payoff is bigger than you could ever imagine. Because here's the question that all of us have to answer at the end of the day. What would it profit you if you gain the whole world, but you lose your soul? Is anything worth more than your soul? Really hearing death's invitation to live out loud is so crucially important, because it's easy to lose touch with the vibrancy of now and spend our whole life chasing hope. The hope that if I could just be someone else or somewhere else, or life could be some way else, then I could finally have this wildly random and unpredictable march of mortality under control. It's the hope that I could make all of my anxieties and insecurities and fears disappear if I could just be taller or shorter or have more hair or less hair or blonde hair or brown eyes or blue eyes or more money or less responsibility or bigger boobs or bigger whatever. Maybe if I'd just chosen my parents better, if I could just run faster or jump higher or do something extraordinary.
Well, hey everyone, excuse the interruption for a quick minute. My name is Kristen. I'm one of the team members here at Eastlake, and we're so glad that you're joining us today on the podcast. It's been so encouraging for us to hear stories from people all over the country and the world who are listening to these messages and resonating with this idea that we just keep saying over and over again, which is life is a gift and love is the point, and that we are all committed to being a beneficial presence in our own communities. So thanks for joining us. I hope that that's resonating with you. It's just really fun for us. So wanted to also say thank you to those of you who contribute. This place, all of these things that we do are happening because of people who make consistent, even just small consistent gifts. It helps us plan. It helps us know that there are really people behind us who want this thing to continue. So thank you to those of you who do that. If you haven't had a chance to give yet, I would encourage you to maybe think about doing that if you find this beneficial in your own life. To make a contribution, it's really easy. You can go to eastlakecc.com and there's a donate button there with all the info. So thanks so much for tuning in. Let's get back to the message.
For me, it was the hope that life could finally be okay if I could just find a way to be someone else. I remember so clearly the day I made a conscious decision that whoever I was, it wasn't good. And the only way that I could get acceptance or love or any reasonable facsimile was to be someone other than who I was. It was grade 2. Now, when I was a kid, I had a vibrant, energetic, colorful, joyful inner life. The problem was my inner life did not always interface well with life around me. When I was 4, my parents were searching for faith, and they went to a little Presbyterian church plant that was in a school like this, and they came to collect me from the Sunday school room. It was in classrooms like we do. And all the other kids were sitting up around the teacher, and I was at the back of the classroom where they had pushed all the desks, and I was in a full sweat. And I was climbing, and I was laughing, and I was enjoying myself. And the teacher looked at my mom and said, "If you ever bring that boy back here again, I am quitting this church." No lie. I'm the only person I know that got expelled from kindergarten. Our teacher had a rabbit warren that she kept so the kids could see the warm little bunnies. And apparently I felt like they would be better to be free and enjoy life. In grade 1, I got kicked off the school bus. I don't know why. I got kicked off the school bus. It was a long walk home, and I noticed that the back bumper of the school bus was nice and big and wide and black. So I just rode that home. All of my friends were inside the bus. I was outside the bus. It's a metaphor for life for me, essentially. Somebody saw, called the police. They came to our home. They were already familiar with the address because apparently shooting your BB gun at your friend's mouthy sister is frowned upon. Who knew? So finally we moved. We went to a new town. And seriously, I'm not lying to you. Went to a new town. I tell people a lot. My parents moved a lot when I was a kid, but I always found them. So we end up in this new town. I go to the first day of grade 2. My grade 2 teacher is Miss Rottenberg. Seriously, weird name. But she was the most beautiful woman I had ever seen. I had such a crush on this woman. What are you in grade 2? Like 7? Dude, I had game from an early age. Miss Rottenberg, when you misbehave in her class, rather than making you do lines a la Bart Simpson, she would make you write out pages of the dictionary. And I wrote out so many pages. And one day, I thought to myself, I love this woman. I need to be better for her. And so I worked up all the courage, all the energy, all the intensity that I could. And I went to school and I sat in my chair and I didn't talk and I didn't do spitballs, and I didn't send notes, and I didn't laugh, and I didn't create a ruckus. I just sat there as attentive as I could muster. Miss Rottenberg walked down the aisle, and she looked at me. She said, "Are you okay?" And I thought to myself, I'm working hard here. You don't like me when I'm just my normal self. And apparently you don't like me when I'm trying to become somebody else. This is a no-win situation. And that day, three controlling narratives became part of the story that I told myself about myself. One, that who I was as a person was wrong and basically defective. Two, that I needed to always have a strategy to make people love and accept me because it wasn't going to happen naturally. And then three, getting love is very difficult and it's unpredictable no matter what you do. And the rest of my school career essentially confirmed those basic assumptions. And I could regale you with a lot of stories, but suffice to say, parent-teacher night was the worst night of the year for me. And at 16, I discovered that I wasn't even acceptable to God. My family had come to faith by that point in time, and I was really involved in the church. Me and some friends, we decided we'd skip school one day. And the backyard fence of our house was the fence of the school. And somehow the principal saw us goofing off and called my mom at work. And she came home and she was beyond furious. And I can remember standing in the kitchen with her and she looked at me and she said, "If this is the kind of person you're going to be, you might as well take your guitar and smash it in a million pieces because God doesn't want music from people like you." And I thought to myself, WTF? If God doesn't want music from people like me, who does he want it from? I'm 16. I'm a virgin. I had never been to a house party. Never drank alcohol, didn't smoke, had never taken drugs. I haven't taken drugs to this day. Although if you have some cool ones, I'm kind of open. Just saying, just putting that out there. I was in church Sunday morning, Sunday night, Tuesday night for Bible study, Friday night for young people. I spent all day Saturday either rehearsing with or traveling with Youth for Christ. And God didn't want music from people like me. And as I began to do therapy and a lot of self-work, I came to realize that I had spent my entire life chasing hope. The tyranny of hope is that it robs you of the present moment and it feeds you an addictive substance called when. When you have, when you are, when you do, then life will be good. But in the process of that pursuit, you find out that hope and fear are two sides of the same coin. And because of that, hope is a very demanding taskmaster. The Christian scriptures put the problem of hope and fear in very succinct terms. 1 John 4:18, fear has torment. Fear fills up every available spot in your heart and mind and meditation with anxiety. It indiscriminately takes up every available space. And hope and fear rob you of the only thing you and I will ever have. The present moment. And there is only one remedy for that. Y'all ready for this? abandon all hope. I know, right? Mind blown. And this is, they took it off. That is so brilliant. I'm sure that some of you took a picture. You're Instagramming it even as we speak. And I know you can imagine the t-shirts, how motivational they would be. When you abandon the hope that life could be better if, then you stop running away from the moment or medicating the moment or ignoring the moment. Abandoning hope is about being present to the moment, whether that moment is precious or painful. Buddhist monk and abbot and author Pema Chodron has a wonderful quote. She said, "Hopelessness is the beginning of the beginning." And the wonder is that we come to find out that hopelessness is also a two-sided coin. And on the other side of hopelessness is compassion, what in Tibetan Buddhism is called Maitri, loving kindness and unconditional friendship with ourselves. If we circle back to that scripture on fear and torment, it goes on to say that perfect love drives out fear. Perfect love. Perfect love. Great compassion for ourselves, great compassion for others on the journey. When you give up the hope that life could be better if you were someone else or somewhere else or owned something else or life had unfolded some other way, then you're able to be right here with great compassion and openness of heart. Right here with the messiness and wonder, spontaneity and drudgery, joy and pain. Reconciled to impermanence and death, and determined to live inside of every moment, to value every moment, to invest in every moment. And in the words of Henry David Thoreau, to put to rout all that is not life, and not when I had come to die, discover that I had not lived. If you don't remember anything else today, take this thought with you. Death is your biggest cheerleader. It sits on the sidelines of your life, just out of view. And it shouts out to you, live! Live! You and I have an appointment, but it's not today, so live! So we want to give you an opportunity to process some of the thoughts of this morning before you move on to the rest of your day. In a minute, the band is going to come and do a piece of music that they did during the earlier set. And while they do, we want to do something very experiential. Yeah, the band, you guys can just come. For people who come from liturgical backgrounds, liturgical church backgrounds, you're familiar with the concept of Ash Wednesday and how at the end of the Mass, ashes, usually in the shape of a cross, are placed on the worshiper's forehead. And the priest says something to the effect, "Remember that you are dust, and to dust you shall return." And in Latin, that is properly called memento mori. So if you went to a church that did Latin rites, that's what the priest would say to you. Memento mori. Remember, you are mortal. Dust you are, and to dust you will return. So around the edges of the auditorium, there are stations just like when we have communion. Only this time they have a little bowl of smudge. And with it, they will put a mark on your hand or your wrist, or if you want it on your forehead, you're welcome to it. Wherever you're comfortable. And when they do, they will look at you and they will say, "Memento mori." I just invite you to let these words enter your heart as an invitation to live fully alive and fully in the moment. And if you want to respond, you can do so with a simple, "Yes, it is so." Memento mori, yes, it is so. Memento mori, yes, it is so. So, if you'd like to participate, when you get to the station, if you want it on your wrist, just hold your wrist out, or the back of your hand, or wherever. While the band sings, you want to participate, just come on and let's do this. We also want you to know that we are putting the final touches on a four-hour workshop called Dying to Live, which will consist of guided meditation and dance and journaling and the creation of your own personal death shield. And if you'd like to be notified about dates and times, and if you just want to take the blue connection card and you can put your just DYL, Dying to Live, DYL, and your contact, whether it's your email or phone, whatever, just put that on there. And as we finalize the date and time, we'll send that information out to you. All right. Would you stand with me as we close, this time for real? When we're all born, we're given the gift of four elements: earth, wind, water, and fire. Child develops in the mother's womb, and the gifts of earth and water form the human frame. And the child emerges from the womb, and with that first breath, fire energy animates the limbs, and breath, wind fills the lungs, and off we go. But all of us only get those four treasures on loan. One day, we will all give them back. The challenge of life is to take those treasures out on a regular basis and ask yourself, am I getting the best return on investment that I can for the treasures that I've been loaned? Ralph Waldo Emerson said, when you were born, you were the only one crying while everybody else was celebrating. Live your life in such a way that when you die, you're the only one happy and everyone else is shedding a tear. And between now and then, may you make every sunrise an opportunity, every meal a banquet, and every sunset a reason for giving thanks. Like the little sign I saw in Woodinville the other day: make today so awesome that yesterday is jealous. Go in peace.